What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today is Alexis Pauline Gums. Sister Dr. Alexis Pauline Gums is a queer Black troublemaker and Black feminist love evangelist and an aspirational cousin to all sentient beings. Her work in this lifetime is to facilitate infinite, unstoppable ancestral love in practice. Her co-edited volume, Revolutionary Mothering Love on the Front Lines, has shifted the conversation on mothering, parenting, and queer transformation. Alexis has transformed the scope of intellectual, creative, and oracular writing with her triptych of experimental works published by Duke University Press, Spill, Scenes of Black Feminist Fugitivity in 2016, and Archive After the End of the World in 2018, and Dub Finding Ceremony 2020. There's so much more in this bio, and I'm going to say more at the end of our interview, but if I read the whole thing and go ooh-ah about all of the amazingness, that will take up the very limited time I have with you. Alexis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. I'm so honored to be here.
I do want to ask you one question about yourself. It's an expansive question about you, because I think that intersects a bit with your walk with Lord. Talk to us about where you're from, your family, how and where you grew up, and when and how did you discover the work of Audre Lorde?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is an expansive question. My family is from multiple shorelines. My family is Anguillian and Jamaican, and they were part of the Windrush migration, and they were also oyster workers in Eastern Shore, Maryland, and they were also Shinnecock folks indigenous to that area they now call the Hamptons. So lots of shorelines. So when Audre Lorde says, for those of us who live at the shoreline, I feel like she's hailing like all my ancestors at one time. And I grew up in a really supportive, loving family. I grew up with parents who had kind of had to work their way out of a Caribbean striving mentality that was imposed on them. And so I watched them. Some people would have called it their midlife crises, but I think it was their rebirths. I watched them reclaim their purpose. And so they were really supportive with us as kids to really listen for, why are we here? And so I loved writing at a very young age. And so my parents were like, every opportunity I could have to be in a writer's group or go to a writing camp or go to a writing program or take an extra writing class, like they were really, really supportive of that. And that's actually how I found Audre Lorde. I was in a feminist writing group, a young feminist writing group at a feminist bookstore, the oldest feminist bookstore in the Southeast, Karis Books and More, which is about to celebrate their 50th anniversary soon. And yeah, we were in where we usually were, this tiny little overflow storage closet in the feminist bookstore. And that's where a professor nearby had assigned Audre Lorde's work, and they had it stacked up in there. And I was like, who is this? And I was 14 years old. Really, the rest is history.
In what ways did she move you?
In every way, for sure. I mean, my first encounters with Audre Lorde were through her poetry. And I know for a lot of people, it's through her prose, through, you know, her incredible essays, or through Zami, her biomythography. But for me, it was her poetry, and it was all of her poetry. It was a purple book that has the collected poems. And I read every single poem, and I was just like in awe. You know, sometimes I was really confused. A lot of the references I wouldn't understand until much later, you know, in my life and in my research. But there was so much beauty there. And I knew that in that layeredness, that beauty, that rigor and specificity, there was more space for life. And, you know, I started to write lines from, I remember headlines from her poem Coal on my bedroom wall. And I would quote her poems as the epigraphs to all my little essays I had to write when I was in high school. And I didn't know, I mean, I was, in fact, an emergent, you know, queer baby, but I didn't know that about myself. I just knew that this was a writer who was saying there is more. And every time I put her words, like as an epigraph to something I wrote, even if it was just like an English paper or a history paper, I could feel her making more space for me to write in a freer way. And I just trusted that. I trusted that impulse, and I just kept her close. And I can't imagine a greater gift to have as, you know, a young queer Black woman coming up than to just have Audre Lorde's words with me at all times. I would paint them on my clothes. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just was like literally clothed in the armor of the Lord. So,
wow. I love that.
Yeah, I felt liberated and embraced and curious. And so this book is really, it's really just part of my gratitude. You know, I have no idea who I would be without the love and ferocity and rigor that her words offered me at an early age. But I mean, I don't want to know. I would rather be the person who's been challenged and inspired by Audre Lorde.
Well, let's start to dig a little bit into her life then. Well, a lot of it, or as much as we can.
Yeah.
So much life. When, where was Audre Lorde born and to whom? And I want to spend some time talking about family life.
Yes. So Audre Lorde was born in Harlem in 1934. And her parents had migrated from the Caribbean. Her mother was from Grenada. And her father had migrated to Grenada, but he was born in Barbados. And she's the youngest of three daughters that they had together. All three of those daughters are born also in Harlem. And, you know, they were a West Indian striving family. They moved to the United States in 1924, about 10 years before Audre was born. And they weathered through the Great Depression. And they, you know, the Harlem riots are like Audre Lorde was 1 year old. So the circumstances that their family was navigating were really serious. But also, as people who migrated from the Caribbean, her parents were both migrating from a majority Black context into a colonial U.S. context where, you know, police harassment and police brutality, for example, was something that they were experiencing based on the color of their skin for the first time. So they were very protective of their children. They were very creative. They were creative in how they just kept their household together and provided for their daughters. And they were aspirational. You know, Audre Lorde's mother was forever taking her daughters to the library that's now the Schomburg, the Harlem branch of the New York Public Library. And her father was always bringing books home for his girls to read. And they really felt like these young women should have every opportunity. But they also felt, you know, terrified about what it meant to protect them in a context that was different than the context that they grew up in.
Talk a little bit about the ways in which they did protect them. You talk about how, you know, this is a time of overt racism. Well, we're back to that time now, but anyway.
Yep.
When they experience that, right, when they experience the violence of racism, the violence of poverty born from racism, in what ways did her parents use that to fortify their children, to use that as teaching tools, which to me, as I was reading about, it's very much culturally Caribbean.
Yeah, I mean, I think that fortify is really the right word that you use. They wanted their children to survive and to be fierce and to, you know, succeed and like take everything that they could have educationally and in terms of opportunity. And so they were like focused. You know, Audre Lorde talks about people literally spitting on them in the street and her mother being like, oh, well, that's really rude for people to be spitting in the street and the wind happens to have it blown our way, you know? Or, you know, when times were hard and they, you know, had to send the kids to bed without dinner, it was always like, is this some vague punishment? You know, like it wasn't ever, there was never an admission that there was something that they could not do as a family. But there were these hard moments, right? Audre Lorde talked about for her whole life, her experience going to Washington, D.C. with her family. And, you know, her dad had mapped this trip out. He was like so interested in these monuments and like the symbols of this nation where, you know, he's trying to have this American dream for his family. And then this is also the furthest south that they had ever traveled as a family. Mm. And that was the first time that Audre Lorde experienced direct segregation, you know, where they couldn't eat in the restaurant that they were trying to go to because it was segregated. It was a no colors allowed situation. So I think that Audre Lorde's parents tried to wrap her and her sisters in this narrative of achievement while also, you know, when they were older, being really specific about like maintain rigid barriers. You know, there's this, you know, Audre Lorde married her husband, Ed Rollins, who is a white gay man. And her mother was terrified. Like, this is a white person. You know, like, we taught you all that these people are not to be trusted, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it was really hard for that intergenerational gap to flow when, you know, here's Audre Lorde trying to bring us into the creative power of difference, and, you know, trying to like revolutionize the ways that we think about community and identity. But I think that ultimately she was able to see that her parents are coming from a perspective of prioritizing the survival of their children. And she ultimately, especially when she became a parent, was able to have more empathy and also more gratitude for the way that her parents were fierce about her survival.
You also point out in the book that Lorde was born in between the two world wars, mm-hmm. and then lived through, right, World War II.
That's right.
And then would have lived through Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the ways in which, and it's something I'm fascinated in, and I think about it a lot in terms of those of us who are militants or, you know, engage in revolutionary practice and are mm-hmm. raising children, the level of violence that they're exposed to our children, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. as young people, and how that impacts the ways in which they see the world. Yeah. How did the inhalation of that kind of violence, world violence, man's inhumanity to man,
mm-hmm.
At such a young age, and then, you know, and then through her life, right, all of these horrible yeah. things happening in the world, how did that shape her worldview, impact her politics, show up in her writing?
Well, you know, she identified as a warrior poet, and she was fascinated with the ancient warriors. She was fascinated with African examples of women warriors. You know, this is something that was really important to her. And when I thought about the fact that, like, oh, right, she's born in between world wars, what war means is shifting in her lifetime. All the power figures in her life are people who are traumatized by these wars. And she's growing up around the corner from, and very conscious of the fact that she's growing up around the corner from where they're inventing the atom bomb. Mm-hmm. And she's reading science fiction. She's thinking about, like, what does it mean that we're not only witnessing, you know, as you said, man's inhumanity to man, but the capacity of a species to destroy itself, to completely eradicate its relationship to the planet and the relationship of a lot of other life from the planet. And so this was really core. And so when we think about Audre Lorde, Tony Cade Bambara's growing up in the same neighborhood, June Jordan's growing up in the same neighborhood, same time period, right? They are having to grow up you know, being taught hide under your desk, but also knowing you're not safe under your desk from a nuclear bomb, you know? And it's to imagine being the first children to grow up with that consciousness, you know, as you say, that exposure to violence, but then also knowing that they're growing up in Harlem and they're growing up subject to police violence. They're becoming mothers and police are killing Black children, right, with impunity in their neighborhoods, and they're aware of this, right? And so Audre Lorde was protesting against wars. She was bringing her children. You know, her daughter has this poem where she talks about watching her mom pack them these little baggy lunches so they can go to the protest, and then this little, you know, washcloth in a plastic bag in case they get tear gassed, and being like, you know, this is her childhood outing, you know, to speak out against the war. But I think it's also important, you know, in relationship, especially, you know, thinking about the work that you do, that Audre Lorde grew up in an occupied space where the police were an occupying force against her community, right? And so the fact that she goes on then to be the first Black professor in the English department of John Jay College, which was created as College of Police Science in order to try to validate policing in the city of New York, is a huge thing. You know, to think about the fact that we know of, she's the first person who is teaching about institutionalized racism to police officers, police administrators, parole officers, people involved in the injustice system that she's protesting in her poetry, right? She's explicitly protesting police murders, in particular the murder of Clifford Glover, in her writing. And she suspects that the police officer that killed Clifford Glover may have been a student in the school where she teaches, right? So all of this is part of Audre Lorde's understanding that she felt like she was at war. And she says this again and again, talking about her children, and she says it to her children. She felt like she had to raise them to be warriors because she understood that they lived in a country where the police could kill them with impunity, right? And not only the police, right? We're like Black children were vulnerable in this particular way. And she thought a lot about, but how do I also, you know, let them have a childhood, you know, and how do I also let them remain curious and be curious about them and let them play and be creative when she was terrified? You know, she was having nightmares, some that she wrote about and some that she just wrote about in her journals, that her kids would be killed by the police.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Alexis Pauline Gums. We are uplifting her new book, Survival is a Promise, the Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. Alexis, what disabilities was Lorde born with? How did that shape her experience of this world?
So Audre Lorde was born with a few disabilities. She was visually impaired. They would say legally blind. Now we might say just extremely, extremely nearsighted, but this wasn't something that was known until, you know, years into her childhood, and when she finally got her first pair of glasses, unfortunately suffering medical violence in the clinic where she got those glasses. She also didn't speak until the age of 4 or 5, so some would call that speech delayed. And she had a stutter, and she, you know, needed to wear orthopedic shoes. She was a child who, you know, her parents did struggle to support her and get her the support that she needed, but she also experienced the world in a particular way, where some of the senses that are considered to be normative parts of like child development, she wasn't relating to those senses in the same way, right? She wasn't relating to speech or sight. She didn't have access to those tools in the ways that our society is designed around children having access to those, right? To be able to grow and develop and be integrated into the system, right? And so this is something that, you know, there's multiple aspects to this, right? There's a, I think about the fact that, well, let's say Audre Lorde talks about it as definitely a form of vulnerability, like what someone might do to you if they know that you can't say anything, you can't tell mm-hmm. anyone, mm-hmm. right? And how terrifying that was for her as a child. But she also talks about it as something that she understands as an influence on her poetic voice. You know, she talks about the fact that she's so nearsighted that she has to bring everything like right up to her eyeball to be able to see it. Otherwise, she's like just seeing this like refracted light. And that was just part of her experience. And she thinks that what she is doing, and she says that what she's doing in her poetry is she's actually trying to bring life close, close, close like that. And then I think about the fact that, you know, if you can't speak, you know, she has to like bring everything close enough to touch, right? She has to like reach out to her parents or her sisters if she needs something. And like, she can't just tell them from across the room, right? They have to interact in a particular way. And she says she's still doing that in her poetry. She's still doing that in her political relationships. She's definitely widely known as a touchy-feely person, right? And you see all the pictures of her and like, she's really in close with people. She's right in their face and she's like holding their hand or holding their shoulder or something. And I think about how that could have been impacted from how she navigated the world as a child. And then, you know, she says that the first words that she spoke or her moving into speech was through memorizing poems. You know, that wonderful Black woman librarian, Augusta Baker at the Harlem branch of the public library, really taught children to memorize poetry. That was one of her key methodologies. And Audre Lorde would start to say the things that resonated with her from the nursery rhymes that she had memorized. And then poetry continued to be her primary language, she would say.
You naturally segued into where I was going to go next. Let's jump ahead, high school life. Mm-hmm. Talk about The Branded.
So The Branded was this group of friends that Audre Lorde was in and like peripheral to at the same time. You know, she was like the only Black girl in this group of like self-identified misfits, right? And they weren't the normal. So Audre Lorde's, one of the things, Audre Lorde's parents made sure that she could take this test to test into a very prestigious and also predominantly white high school, Hunter High School for Girls at the time. It's now co-ed. And, you know, she and these other friends who included like the beat poet Diane De Prima, who, you know, lived most of her life out in the Bay Area, they were not the normal ideal Hunter girl. And they leaned into it. They were like, okay, we're witches, you know, like we're going to have seances. We're going to see if we could do telepathy with each other. We're going to read, you know, romantic poetry and light candles. And we're going to just be really weird because why not, you know? And for them, there was a play, a freedom, but also a learning that they were doing and a poetic work that they were doing with that energy. But at the same time, everybody else in The Branded was white. And so when you read, for example, if you read Diane De Prima's autobiography that she wrote later in her life, she talks about the fact that like she couldn't invite Audre Lorde over to her house, right? So like these white girls did not have parents that would say, oh, you have a Black friend, like bring her over, right? But they would go to each other's houses, right? So in a way, Audre Lorde was part of this group, but she was also peripheral to this group because they were living segregated lives, even in New York City. So Yeah, the branded is a space that, you know, I in this book, I really wanted folks to have an opportunity to be with like Audre Lorde the child, Audre Lorde the teenager, because, you know, just like me, like I was first impacted by Audre Lorde, the full grown poet, thinker, feminist icon, you know, who's so powerful and empowered all of us, you know, in my generation. And I think it's important to understand that we could understand Audre Lorde in the ways that we understand ourselves. You know, like every age of us is still right here in us. And that vulnerability of being like a teenager, feeling super insecure and having to deal with an institution where you definitely will never fit in, and having heartbreak, you know, like, I mean, heartbreak, like crush on your English teacher heartbreak, but heartbreak, like your best friend dying by suicide, you know, like the things that we go through as young people that shape us, you know, there are things that is something, the death of her best friend, Genevieve, is something that shaped Audre Lorde's life. She never stopped writing about Genevieve, ever.
Say more about Genevieve and their relationship.
So Genevieve was another friend from school who was not a part of the branded. She was a Black girl. She was a ballerina. And she and Audre became very, very close and spent a lot of time together. But Genevieve was suicidal and she was having problems at home. The ways those problems show up in different sources is different, but unfortunately, she died by suicide at the age of 16. And this was something that she shared with Audre her suicide plan. Not necessarily the details of it, but like the fact that she wanted to do this. And Audre felt, you know, something that unfortunately too many people in the world have felt, that she wished that she could have saved Genevieve. She forever thought, was there something that she could have done? Was there something that she could have said that could have made a difference? And for the rest of her life, she continued to be in conversation with Genevieve through her poetry. She would go into phone booths and just call and say what she needed to say to Genevieve. She would look for messages from her, like in the TV weather reports. You know, she just was, she felt accountable to Genevieve forever. But she also, I mean, for years and years, I mean, actually decades, would have nightmares when it would come again to the anniversary of Genevieve's death, right? So it was something that it shaped. It was a traumatic event. It was a loss. I think that there's something about losses when someone dies by suicide that become very complicated to grieve, because there's all this wonder about like, could it have been different, or what could I have done, or how are we complicit in each other's lives? Like, what is our responsibility to save each other? Sometimes even from ourselves. And I think that it also tells us something and maybe impacted the way that Audre Lorde thought about life and death and how interconnected our lives are, and that death is not the end, you know, from her view. And how do we live if we understand that we're so profoundly interconnected and that our lives are not just one individual life? They actually are something at once messier than that and more beautiful than that, and really related to this possibility of impact. You know, she thought about, what is the shape of my impact upon this earth?
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Alexis Pauline Gums. We are uplifting her book, Survival is a Promise, the Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. It really is a gift that you give us in the book to be able to spend time and space in the places of Lorde's life that really we don't access anywhere else in the ways in which she's presented to us. I do want to spend the last 15 minutes or so that I have with you talking about some of her theory, her politics, her analysis. And I want to start with, and you alluded to it earlier, but identity. Mm-hmm. In what ways did Lourdes celebrate the many aspects of and intersections of her identity?
You know, this is really important for her. And, you know, some of the things that we talked about before, about how she grew up and what it was like in school, she felt like she was the only, so often, right? She felt like she was the only Black person here and the only lesbian here and the only woman here, you know, like all of those things. But she also was very astute to how aspects of our identities are policed for political purposes, right? And so she was like, oh, there's something about the fact that I'm the only Black woman and the only lesbian who's asked to speak at this conference, and I was asked to speak at the last minute, that actually is not just about ignorance and, ouch, this hurts my feelings to be here alone, even though those things matter. It's also, this is systemic and this is what enables this institution. In that case, she was talking about the institution of her own employment, City University of New York, to continue to be homophobic and to be racist, even as it's supposedly having a feminist conference, right? You know, this is how she saw it. So when she thought about the fact that as a breast cancer survivor, people were telling her, oh, you need to like wear a prosthesis and you need to pass for someone who has not had a mastectomy. She was like, oh, wait a minute. It's happening again. And why is it happening? It's happening because what would be the power of cancer survivors actually collectivizing and not just being individual patients at the mercy of a medical industry that's not listening to them, right? So when we think about how Audre Lorde thought about identity, I think it's important for us to remember, and I know you know this, but I think it's important for us to say, those of us who are in Audre Lorde's lineage of transformative social justice movements, that it wasn't just about, oh, say the right thing, oh, you know, include a token lesbian or, you know, whatever. It was like, where we are being fed the lie of disconnection, alienation, and disempowerment inside of capitalism is through this idea that we should have to be silent about who we are. And we should not be able to identify ourselves to each other to build power together around some of our shared oppressions, around some of our shared dreams, but also to build power across our different oppressions and our different lived experiences. Because when we collectivize in those ways, the systems that benefit from having us think we're just isolated people out here who have to hustle and who need what these institutions are supposedly providing, we are dangerous to the perpetuation of that status quo when we are together as who we are, right? So it's multi-directional. She was saying that she should be able to love every aspect of who she is, right? And sometimes, you know, I love reading her author's bios because she will say, I'm a Black, lesbian, feminist, warrior, poet, mother. But sometimes she'll keep going, high maintenance, fat, nearsighted, you know, she'll just keep going. Yeah. And what she's saying is both, I love these parts of me. You can't use this against me, right? You can't be like, well, I'm gonna out you as a lesbian so that now I can control you, right? She also was saying, hey, I'm here too. So if you're a lesbian in here, If you're a nearsighted person in here, if you also are a high maintenance person in here, you're not alone. Yeah. And she felt alone, right? She was part of the Harlem Writers Guild growing up. She didn't know Langston Hughes, who was a very important person in that guild, was gay. So she thought she was the only person up in there. You know, mm-hmm. She didn't know Angelina Weld Grimke had lived in Harlem and was writing these poems about loving women. She thought It was just her. And she did not want to reproduce that. She did not want to perpetuate people thinking they were isolated in ways that were not even true. And this is one of her great offerings. You know, I personally benefit from that, right? That she was like, I have to have space to be all of who I am, and I'm going to make it clear everywhere within the sound of her voice, which is a sound of a voice that moved beyond her lifetime because it moved through her writing, that we wouldn't have to feel like it was impossible to be who we are. And that goes beyond the specific identities that she held to actually be part of a greater inquiry of like whoever we are, you know, like whatever about us seems like unheard of. It doesn't have to be unheard because we don't have to be silent about it, right?
I should have asked you that last because those have been like powerful words. But you got to be brilliant again, so it's okay. contributions of Lord to Black feminist theory and thought, and how do they still reverberate today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just like I said, I wouldn't want to imagine like who would I be without Audre Lorde's words in my life. I mean, what would Black feminist theory be? I think that there's, I mean, her impact is literally formative, right? She is one of the founders of Black women's studies. She is one of the first people to teach a women's studies course ever. So she's in these conversations where, you know, she's thinking about this. Sonia Sanchez is thinking about this. Toni Capenbar is thinking about this. Like, what do we offer to another generation? What do we make our students read? You know, like all of these questions. But also, very specifically, Audre Lorde was motivated by and accountable to a generation of Black feminists like 15 years younger than her, who would be Barbara Smith, Demita Frazier, Beverly Smith, Akasha Gloria Hull. I could keep naming people, Cheryl Clark, you know, people who among them would be the writers of the Combahee River Collective Statement, which is one of the most important Black feminist documents because it was important in its time for what it named about the imperative, the intergenerational, transformative, socialist imperative of Black feminism. But it's important now because it reverberates across time, but also because people have continued to teach it and to reference it and to think about it, right? So this idea that the major forms of oppression are interlocking, which they articulate in that statement, is fundamental to how Black feminist theory lives and finds a place for itself today. Audre Lorde wrote Zami because of those sisters. You know, literally, she met Barbara Smith, she met Akasha Hull at an academic conference, and she, you know, Akasha Hull is doing this research about Alice Dunbar Nelson, and they're like, you know, digging to find like lesbian precedents and Black feminist icons, you know, in our literary history. And Audre Lorde was like, oh, well, I have to tell my story in a way that's useful to them, right? And I need to show up in community with them, right? She went to the Black feminist retreats that the Combahee River Collective did in the Northeast for a number of years. And she was involved in those conversations where they were saying, what is survival? What is our response to the nuclear question? How are we thinking about mothering and daughtering? How are we thinking about what we should prioritize and what we should do? You know, she has this letter I was looking at the other day where at the retreat, somebody had brought up this invitation to come like basically teach white feminists about Black feminism. And she wrote this letter that was like, yeah, that would be nice. But like, what if we prioritize Black women and the conflicts we have between us, the differences we have between us? What about class and Black women of different classes trying to come together to empower each other? And so those were really important to not only how those people were all transformed in those conversations, and those people end up being, right, like the publishers, the creators of the first Black feminist anthologies. Yes, the professors. Yes, the founders of organizations. Yes, the mentors of generations of people. It's like the fierceness and the love comes through. And Audre Lorde was intentional about that. She was intentionally in those intergenerational relationships for that reason. And then she was intentionally creating transnational relationships, right? She was connecting the Black feminists in the United States with the Afro feminists, the Afro-German feminists in Germany, and the self-identified Black indigenous folks in Australia, and the Black women freedom fighters in South Africa, and the Black women writers in the Caribbean, you know, like all of this, right? So to the extent that Black feminist theory is, which it is, an intergenerational, political, transnational paradigm, this is in its existence a reverberation of Audre Lorde's participation and her vision, obviously not solely in community the whole time with all these folks, but it was so important to her. It was at the center of her heart. She's on an airplane in her journal writing about possibility of Black feminist aesthetic. And she's like, she got to like take her sweatshirt off. She's like sweating. You know, she's just like, this is so exciting and it's so important to me. And I love thinking about that because, you know, I'm a Black feminist writer and scholar, right? I live in and as a reverberation of that desire.
Over the weekend, I went to go see a play called The Black Feminist Guide to the Human Body. And yeah.
I want to see it so bad.
Lisa Thompson.
Yes,
yeah.
Lisa Thompson.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. I want to see it. But there was this, piece of the play where really talking about the cost to us. Black women, our bodies. I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And they do this slideshow. Because, I mean, we're talking about it more now, but still not enough. Mm-hmm. Right? About how deadly it is to be a Black woman in this country. Yeah. Or in the world, excuse me.
That's right.
And much less talking about how deadly it is to be a Black woman who does the kind of work that, you know, we're engaged in. Mm-hmm. So they have this slideshow, right? And I think one of the lines in the play says, you know, any death before 75 is a premature death.
That's right.
And then they go through all these Black women that died too soon. And so, right, Audre Lorde, 58, Toni Cade Bambara, 56, June Jordan, 65.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I really have a question or if I just want to make space for you to reflect on that. I haven't been able to shake that out of my body. And I've really been thinking about, I hate the word self-care. That's not what healing justice is. We don't get messed up together and then send people off by themselves to get better.
Right. That's right.
But thinking about how and what ways we can find a pathway to taking better care of ourselves as an act of resistance. Mm-hmm. Like, what does the rejection of the paradigm of premature death for Black women look like in action?
That's right. That's such an important question. That's such an important work that Lisa Thompson has created. And it's such a visceral loss. You know, so many of us have people in our families. And we're thinking about premature death, but also, you know, I'm on a daily basis present to the fact that all these 100 zillion questions that I want to ask Audre Lorde, I want to ask June Jordan, I want to ask Toni Cade Bambara, and it's totally plausible that I would have been able to. We can't, right? We can't have those conversations, those intergenerational conversations that we need. And I also believe that certainly those three women, but like so many people they did live their whole lives. You know, like they did, I think, keep their promise in terms of their impact. And they offer these lessons, right? So to your question, Audre Lorde had to think about that so specifically when she got her cancer diagnosis. Like, what does it actually mean for me to take care of myself? And the way she thought about it, because again, she's like, I'm a warrior. This is a war we're in. Her life and the time of her life, which is a life spent building these connections, building political power, articulating just a transformation in consciousness. Her being stopped from doing that is like racism winning. You know, that's how she thought about it. And she was like, okay, what do I have to do? And if we look at what she did, not that this would be the same for everyone, but a lot of these things resonate with me. She said, you know what? I'm in a toxic environment. We're in a toxic environment. And this is one of the things that was important to her about saying being a cancer survivor is a political identity, because our communities are dealing with cancer because of what? You know, the terminology wasn't there, but she was talking about environmental racism. She was talking about the food system. She was talking about her toxic academic workplace, right? So she left. She left City University of New York. She was a named endowed professor. So she didn't leave like, oh, I was an adjunct and I stopped doing that, right? Not to say that if you are an adjunct, you shouldn't stop doing that if that's the healthy thing. But just to understand, you know, she was the Thomas Hunter named professor at Hunter. You know, where Thomas Hunter has said he didn't even think that Black people were really capable of learning. This is a big deal. And she was like, but my life and what I'm here to do, I have to not be in this toxic environment. And she was like, I got to leave New York City. I have to actually be warm. I actually have to have access to food that's supporting me and not poisoning me. And that you could barely find such food in the whole United States, right? She became an advocate for immunotherapy approaches to cancer, like to profoundly supporting her immune system, when that was not even considered an option at the time. Now it is, partially because of people like Audre Lorde. And so all of that is to say, Audre Lorde had to break up with a lot of institutional relationships that were disempowering her and build alternative collectivities, right? Build collectively with the folks in Germany, the healers in Germany, with the sisters in the Caribbean, with a beekeeping collective, you know, like all of the things. And I wonder about this. You know, Audre Lorde brings up this question for me. What are the institutional relationships, the normalized patterns that we have to break up with in order to save our lives? And we can only do that if we can actually replace, like you still have to have food, right? For Audre Lorde, she still had to have intellectual community. She still had to live somewhere, right? And there wasn't anywhere she could go on the planet that was absolutely free from colonialism and racism and, you know, all of these things. But she was committed to being part of the creation of something else and modeling it. And so I think, you know, that's one answer to the question of what it looks like. I think that there was a time in Audre Lorde's life where she was like, she lived in New York her whole life. What does life even look like outside of New York? I mean, she also, and this is not to throw any shade, She also left a relationship with a white partner and went into a relationship with a black woman, you know, like all of these things. But they were her question of what is life-giving? Like, what was really life-giving for her? And what could be life-giving? And what forms of collectivity, what forms of support, what forms of mutual aid, right, were required to have that happen? There was a lot of vulnerability in that. What does it mean to be, you know, like she was, this endowed, prestigious professor, and then to go to a place where, you know, the government's going to totally abandon you during a hurricane, and you got to depend on the Sisters of Ashe out in the Bay Area to get the people together to send the tarps and the lanterns and the very basic tools of survival that you and your community need, you know, and to then distribute those things, like to think about the fact that her visibility as the Audre Lorde, you know, at this point in her career, successful poet, could be instead of used to reproduce Hunter College and their idea of what a collective is, could instead be used to rally Black lesbians in the United States to be in solidarity with a community surviving a hurricane in St. Croix. But that's what she wanted to use it for, right? And so we're redirecting our energy into the collectivities that are most life-saving for us. Either way, our energy is part of a collectivity, whether that collectivity is called the United States of America and its taxpayer base, whether that collectivity is called such and such college or university or corporation or whatever that is, or if it's another type of collectivity that prioritizes the life and energy of those people creating it together over the reproduction of the destructive forms of institution building that are dominant in our society right now. So the model that Audre Lorde offers for what it means to save our lives is a real one. Now, this is to say she still died at age 58, but she lived 12 years longer than her prognosis because she made all of these different changes, right? And if she had known what she knew when she knew it before she knew it, we know what she knew when she knew it earlier because she shared it. Like she literally was like, here are my journals from going through cancer. Here they are. Here's what I did. Here's what it meant. Here's how hard it was. Here's how grateful I am. You know, all of those things. And so some of us have the opportunity to look at our institutional relationships before we're in a major health crisis, thanks to those people who generously shared about their experiences who didn't have that. And so it becomes just as important that Audre Lorde said, I am a Black lesbian feminist warrior poet for the future Black queer folks and Black lesbians and queer people of color who would come behind, as for her to say, the university is killing me, I'm leaving. I'm sitting here meditating, retraining my cells to be freedom fighters, understanding that these cancer cells in me are like the South African military police. That's what she said. And so I grieve the early deaths, the premature deaths of anyone, especially our Black women writers, because those are exactly the people I turn to the most. And I have this deep gratitude. I think that the best way that I can honor them and that we can honor them is from really listening to the lessons they left behind, really looking at the institutions that impacted them deeply negatively, and look at how they said there's other ways. You know, they were teaching in prisons. They were teaching in the alternative schools that their students created when they took over the buildings, right? they were practicing so many forms of life. And all of those examples, you know, they were in the living room talking about what do we do about nuclear energy, all of that. And I think there's actually an abundance of answers to that question, given by the same people who remind us that we need to ask ourselves that question when we remember how many years we wish, how many more years we wish we could have had with them.
Oof. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. You all have been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today has been Alexis Pauline Gums, Sister Dr. Alexis Pauline Gums. I'm gonna do some more of the bio, but I like this. Is a queer Black troublemaker and a Black feminist love evangelist. Alexis's work as a media maker and her curricula for participatory digital education have been activated in 143 countries. Her digital distribution initiative, Broken Beautiful Press, her work as co-founder of Quirky Black Girls, and her loving participation in the Women of Color Bloggers Network in the early 2000s established her as one of the forerunners of the social media life of feminist critical and creative practice. Alexis has been honored with many awards from her communities of practice, including being lifted up on lists such as Utney Reader's 50 Visionaries Transforming the World, The Advocate's 40 Under 40, Go Magazine's 100 Women We Love, The Bitch 50 List, Color Lines 10, LGBTQ Leaders Transforming the South, Reproductive Justice Rally Check, Shiro's, and more. She's a proud recipient of the Too Sexy for 501c3 Trophy, a Black Women's Blueprint Visionary Award, and the Barnard College Outstanding Young Alumna Award. I could go on and on. We will link to the amazing bio in the archive of this show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kat. Thank you, Kat. Ooh, you went all the way in. I'm so grateful.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.